You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Human Rights Watch is an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy. In partnership with local activists and human rights groups, they expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. They rely on the support of informed, dedicated people, so visit hrw.org/kick to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. hrw.org/kick. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Today, I'm happy to welcome back to the podcast legendary magazine editor Tina Brown. Having revived the British society magazine Tatler, she took over as editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair in 1982, revamping the magazine from front to back and raising magazine sales by 600%. Tina Brown later went on to perform a similarly dramatic turnaround at The New Yorker before turning the magazine world upside down by creating the digital publication The Daily Beast. Since then, she's founded the Women in the World Summit and launched Tina Brown Live Media to expand women in the world internationally, and she recently launched a new podcast called TBD with Tina Brown. And today, Tina returns to the show to talk about growing up in an entertainment family, how she got expelled from 3 different boarding schools for being, quote, a subversive influence, and how that same subversiveness was just what she needed when she embarked on a career in journalism. Tina talks about her 37-year marriage to the former editor of the Sunday Times, Harry Evans, and their morning ritual of having breakfast and poring over the papers together in what she calls their news buffet. She talks about turning around The New Yorker after her successful run at Vanity Fair, how she adapted from magazines to the immediacy of digital news when she founded The Daily Beast, and what it was like working with media mogul Barry Diller. She recalls her torturous years running Talk Magazine with the infamous Harvey Weinstein, finding some peculiar contracts when she was the editor of the magazine and head of Talk Books, and she discusses leading the charge of the Me Too era with her Women in the World Summit. She reveals what recently attracted her to the world of podcasting, how her new show, TBD with Tina Brown, in many ways is a return to her roots as a journalist, and why what she calls the mix still matters whether you're running a magazine or a podcast. Plus, the author of The Diana Chronicles has a little advice for Meghan Markle on how to navigate palace intrigues. Coming up with the legendary Tina Brown in just a moment. Tina Brown has served as editor of Tatler, Vanity Fair, and The New Yorker between 1979 and 2001 before taking magazines online when she founded The Daily Beast in 2008. In 2010, she founded the Women in the World Summit and launched Tina Brown Live Media to expand women in the world internationally. Now she's launched a new podcast called TBD with Tina Brown. Tina, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here.
Last time we spoke, We talked a lot about your time at Vanity Fair and your terrific book about those years, The Vanity Fair Diaries. So this time, I want to go back and talk a little bit about the pre- and post-Vanity Fair years leading all the way up to your latest venture, this podcast, TBD. Mm-hmm. First off, we didn't talk a lot about your childhood last time around. You grew up in an entertainment family. Your dad was a movie producer and your mom was an assistant to Laurence Olivier, right?
Yes, that's right. My father was very much a movie producer. He did all those kind of Agatha Christie comedies and lots of that kind of wonderful light comedy stuff of that British era. But he was always looking for material, which really made stories the kind of center of our lives growing up. You know, everything for my dad was like a story. Would it make a film? And I'm sure that kind of fed into my viewing everything I do really as a kind of quest for great stories in magazines or a fabulous piece of commentary or a guest I can book. It's kind of runs in the genes.
Yeah, and you mentioned that he did the Agatha Christie movies. I think the Miss Marple books. Did you ever get to know Dame Agatha Christie, or were you a big mystery reader?
I didn't meet Dame Agatha Christie, but I got very friendly with Dame Margaret Rutherford, who played the character in the Miss Marples.
Oh, really?
I used to sit upon her knee as a child growing up, but yeah, it was fun. I used to love going to the set at Pinewood Studios, and my one of my favorite memories actually was when my dad took me to see. Took us to Twickenham Studios where he was making a film, and I was able to go and visit the set of Help where the Beatles were filming. You can imagine what that was like for a 14-year-old girl who was 100% obsessed with John Lennon. Of course, I was obsessed with John, but it was Paul who was nice to me, which I think is kind of the story of that relationship.
Now, I mentioned that your mom was an assistant to Laurence Olivier. Did you ever get to meet him?
Yes, I did. I mean, she worked on Henry V, and you know, when he was making those Shakespeare films, and when he was, you know, having his deep love affair with Vivian Leigh. So all of these people used to swirl around Pinewood Studios when I used to go and meet in Twickenham and Elstree, the studios in England. So it was a fun growing up because, there was always actors, producers, writers running through our house. You know, there was always a new, the latest James Bond, you know, kind of lying under the Christmas tree trying to, like, recover from an alcoholic stupor. But it was a pretty, my parents were great at giving parties. The rap parties of my parents were kind of legendary when they would just have everybody around and it would be a great carouse.
I can only imagine. Now, you've described yourself as a subversive influence in your youth, so much so that you were expelled from three different boarding schools. What did you do to get in so much trouble?
I was such trouble. It wasn't the kind of glamorous ejections like, you know, drugs, sex, drugs, rock and roll at all. Yeah. I was just incredibly, subversive. I mean, I just used to make trouble and answer back and be insubordinate to teachers. And actually, one of my ejections happened because I decided to take everybody on strike across the lacrosse pitch, protesting the fact that at this boarding school I was at, this very stuffy boarding school, we had to wear two pairs of underwear and the outer pair could only be changed every 3 days. So I had everyone marching across the lacrosse pitch, waving placards saying, knickers out, out, out. Unfortunately, it was me that was out, unfortunately. I was immediately ejected. But the great thing about my parents was that they always had my back. So they were quite used to me being expelled. So my father and mother would show up and my father would say to the head teacher who'd be sitting there looking incredibly, you know, disapproving, he would say, it must be a terrible thing for you to have failed with this incredibly talented child.
Did that insubordination serve you well in the magazine business?
Well, it did. I mean, I would argue that insubordination is the first thing a journalist needs to have, right? I mean, I think it was my journalistic, irreverence and refusal to necessarily just accept what authority told me that made me a good journalist. So, sure, when I went into magazine journalism, it was questioning authority that made me do some of the best pieces, in my career. So I think that it's a pretty good trait to have if you want to be a journalist.
During your time at Oxford, I read that you used to do some acting on the stage and write plays. How come you decided to go into publishing instead of the family business?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I did write two plays, actually, that were both performed at the Edinburgh Festival and also in London in the kind of off-Broadway, as it were, environment. Really? And I loved doing that. But I began writing for the university, for Oxford sort of magazine, because my friend was the editor. And somehow that led me into journalism. And I guess it was an easier way to make a living. You know, I had always thought that I might be a playwright and be in the theatre, but really it was journalism that took off for me immediately. My pieces were noticed quite early on and got me published in magazines, you know, and newspapers. So it set me on that course pretty young. I mean, by the age of 24, I was already an established columnist and writer for the Sunday Times.
Yeah, and it wasn't much longer after that that you met your husband and legendary publisher, Harry
Evans.
That's
right, that's right. As soon as I, he was the editor-in-chief of the Sunday Times newspaper, right. A famous sort of crusading editor. We met and fell in love, and as soon as that happened, I left because I didn't want to be, or rather he insisted I leave, and I absolutely happy to do so because I didn't want to be there with him as the kind of, and actually that's really what set me into editing, because I thought, well, if I can't write for the Sunday Times because I'm involved with Harry, then I really want to have my own publication. And I started thinking about becoming an editor, and then I was offered the Tatler at the age of 25, which was an amazing sort of break in those days, but it happened. And, you know, everything took off from that.
You said it was love at first sight with him. What did you see in Harry way back then?
Oh, my God, it was certainly love at first sight. I had been writing for the Sunday Times, and he liked what he'd read, and so he asked if he could meet me to see, you know, if I could have any, what other role I could do. And typically of Harry, he kept me waiting, you know, for sort of 25, 30 minutes. Time was ticking by, and I feared suddenly that I wasn't going to get to see him. And I looked through the door, and there he was laying out the front page. It was just so glamorous. There he was, you know, in his kind of suspenders and shirt sleeves and blue pencil, literally sort of, you know, surrounded by his news editors, laying out some major front page splash. And I kind of surged through the door and kind of like presented myself. And he looked at me and he said, "Don't bother me now, love." And he turned away from me and left me standing there. And I thought, woo, you know, zing goes my heart with those blue eyes. And, you know, it was love at first sight for me. It took him a little longer, but I made up for it later with him.
Yeah, yeah. He knows how to play hard to get, huh? Now, how long has it been? 36, 37 years of marriage at this point?
Yes, yes. Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Yeah, we've been together really ever since. And you know, our great passion together has been journalism, editing. He's still the person whose opinion I treasure the most. You know, when I was editing the magazines that I edited, he was always the first critic and the encourager when things were tough and so on. And I hope, you know, vice versa. You know, he joined me in America after the Sunday Times, and he became president of Random House. So he became a book publisher here. And we, you know, we made our life here in a wonderful way, and, you know, had our two children here who are now Americans. So we had this whole second act. He's 25 years older than me, so it was like a second act for him, and you know, a great adventure for us coming together at the same time.
What's the secret to 37 years of marriage?
Well, passion for the same things. You know, we mm-hmm. are, you know, we're obsessed with journalism, politics, writing, reading. You know, these are our passions, and so those are things that age well. Let's put it that way. You know, the weekends, we're sort of holed up in front of the fire, having our happiest times, devouring, you know, our literary banquet for the weekend, and plotting what to watch on Netflix.
Yeah, I've read that you've had this tradition of either at home or going to a cafe, having breakfast over the papers, and now I guess digital media, your phones, your tablets, and
absolutely
discussing the news, huh?
It's wonderful. I get my hour and a half burst of pure kind of editing brilliance from Harry, who goes through everything, you know, on his iPad or in the papers, and we just discuss everything that's just happened. And you know, he gives his take, and I give my take, and I feel mm-hmm. by the end of it, I'm done. I'm happy. I'm tanked up for the day.
Do those conversations get pretty spirited? Do you ever disagree on politics?
Well, he has a habit, actually, of constantly telling me to read something at a time when he's got the paper, or he's got, you know, it's like, well, if you could just shut up a minute, I'll read it. You know, no, you've got to read it now. But I'm reading this other thing you just told me to read.
Now, we talked a lot about your time at Vanity Fair last time. I want to fast forward to the post-Vanity Fair years, because you did a lot of interesting stuff in those decades. We didn't really talk about your time as editor of The New Yorker. Now, you improved the magazine sales substantially during your tenure, but it was a tough time for The New Yorker. Do you think that Americans just didn't have the appetite for smart, literate magazines anymore?
Well, I mean, magazine really took, you know, we turned it around. I mean, when I took over The New Yorker in 92, it was really on its kind of last legs, really. I mean, it had a tremendous literary heritage, but advertisers were leaving and readers were leaving and aging. And so it was my job to kind of be the change maker. And it was the most exciting and exhilarating time. Not easy, because I had to lay off, like, you know, 70 people and hire another 40. But the 40 that I hired are all still there. I mean, I hired David Remnick, the current editor, Malcolm Gladwell, who famously wrote The Tipping Point, Jane Mayer, the great investigative writer, Jeffrey Toobin was a young assistant DA that I hired, who, of course, became a very big legal writer and CNN commentator. So we really refreshed the blood brilliantly, frankly, of The New Yorker, and brought in a whole new team who stayed for the last 25 years. So, you know, it was a wonderful time. We won the first, excellence award that The New Yorker had actually won at the National Magazine Awards. So we really did turn the magazine around. I was there for nearly 7 years, and I think it was some of the most exciting times of my life. I also brought photographs to the magazine, which had never been used really before. I brought Richard Avedon, the great photographer, in as our sort of staff photographer. I changed the covers and added color and redesigned it. It was a very, very creative period in my life, actually, for which I'm, I'll always almost be prouder than I am of what we did at Vanity Fair, mm-hmm. because I think we sort of saved a literary jewel and revamped it for the next, two decades, which is, something of an achievement, I feel.
Was that a tough sell in your mind, getting Americans interested in smart, literate pieces and short fiction and that type of thing again? Because New Yorker really is a throwback.
Yeah, it is. I mean, except that I think people are always hungry for great content. And what I brought mm-hmm. to The New Yorker, which hadn't been there before, was, The New Yorker's a weekly, and I felt it wasn't using its weekly frequency in an exciting way, that in fact, the magazine should have two rhythms going on. Yes, it should have fiction. Yes, it should have long, leisurely, interesting textured pieces. But I also brought a journalistic gene back into it, so that the front of the magazine would always have something that you had to read. I felt The New Yorker should be competitive with what else was happening in the culture. And so Jeffrey Toobin, for instance, did a most extraordinary job kind of following and creating and making the news on the O.J. Simpson story, which, he brought so much kind of legal know-how and contacts to. He broke a tremendous amount of news in that. I hired Jim Stewart to be a great business writer so that we were following all the great business stories and making a lot of news so that we were able to combine the kind of the literary history and the wonderful writers like John Updike and Janet Malcolm and so on, but with the newsy journalists who I brought in, who added that additional Seymour Hersh, for instance, the great investigative journalist I brought to The New Yorker. All of these people came under my sort of watch, and I think I woke it up. I made it something that people felt they had to read. As when people used to say to me, "I love The New Yorker, I keep it in the log basket by my bed," I think, "Oh God." That's bad news. I got to get it out of that log basket, into your hands, so that when you're jumping, into a cab or on the subway, you're mm-hmm. taking it with you and reading it there. And that's what I think we did achieve.
You definitely made The New Yorker relevant again. And after The New Yorker, I want to say that's when you took 2 years off to write the Diana Chronicles about Princess Diana. Is that right? Or was that after
Talk? Well, actually, no. I mean, before that, I had my wonderful adventure in craziness, which was I left The New Yorker for probably the most bizarre career move looking back than anyone might make. But I thought I had wanted to make The New Yorker more than a magazine. And frankly, mm-hmm. I was very prescient, because I wanted to make it into a content engine, a driver of movies, books, plays, radio shows. And there was no appetite for that at Condé Nast. So I then, guess who came and offered to do that very thing with me, which was Harvey Weinstein at Miramax. Right. And he came to me and asked if I would start a magazine that would basically be a content engine for other things, for movies, for books, for so on. So I did. I left The New Yorker and went to work with Harvey to create Talk Magazine. Which, actually was one of the best magazines I've done. I mean, it had some fantastic stuff in it, but it was such an insane 2 years, because working with Harvey was not at all, anything like what I thought it was going to be. He never sexually harassed me, but it was just such an anarchic environment. He was such a volatile, intemperate kind of guy to work for, that it was very destabilizing. And then in the middle of it all, 9/11 happened, and the bottom fell out of the advertising market. And Harvey, of course, had no patience or the budget really for that. He wasn't going to wait that out. So he closed the magazine, which was a very kind of tough time. I mean, I'd found the most amazingly talented people who all went on to do great stuff. I mean, they all went to populate the New York Times, New Yorker, all of these places. But, you know, it folded. So I was left very kind of, you know, wrecked by that experience. You know, I was very, very distraught about it. And after a while, I decided I wanted to go back to really what was my own DNA always, which was writing. And I did my book 2 years doing my biography of Princess Diana, the Diana Chronicles, which became a number one bestseller. So it was a very good move on my part, and also a very kind of regenerating thing to do, because to just be immersed in my book, to go back to the time in the 80s when I had been at Tatler in London and sort of retrace the early life of Diana, who'd been so much a part of my early editing career when I was at Tatler. It was a really kind of, it was hard to do. But I interviewed about 300 people, some of whom would give me just the smallest bit of information that I could then really use. But I did get her circle and all the royal circle to talk to me in ways they hadn't before. So it was a really wonderful book to do. And at the end of it, I felt kind of regenerated and ready to go and start the Daily Beast with Barry Diller, who invited me to do that. So
right.
You know, he wanted me to do a new online site. And I didn't think I wanted to do that. I said, I'm a print gal. It's not what I do. He said, well, come and give it a go. And if you don't want to do it, you know, fine, start something. Look, let's look at it. And if you don't want to continue, I understand. And as soon as I got working on it, I realized that online journalism was the most incredible thing for me. You know, it was something that was commensurate to my impatience. You know, I'm so impatient. I love news. I want to see the stories done. I want to see them out. And here was this thing, this online thing, which could, you know, I could immediately respond to the news, immediately assign a piece and see it up and see it getting traction. And I found it really exciting. And I called it the Daily Beast after a famous novel written by the great English satirist Evelyn Waugh, Scoop, which is about Fleet Street journalism. And in it, the kind of satirical newspaper, you know, that he writes about is called The Daily Beast. So I've always wanted to call something The Daily Beast. It sounded kind of feral and edgy and slightly out of control, which I think is a great thing for a news publication. And I called it The Daily Beast, and it really took off pretty much immediately. It was an enormous fun, that whole project.
Having been a print publisher up to then, was that digital learning curve pretty steep, or what was that like?
No, it really wasn't. It was instantaneous. I realized because what I loved doing was, I mean, in those days I had a BlackBerry, and I would sit in my diner in the morning with Harry, and I would read like 20 stories, and I would start firing off instantly like email commissions all over the place to Washington, New York, LA, you know, like, why don't you do a piece about this? Why don't you do a piece about that? And I have such a big Rolodex, frankly, having, you know, edited so many magazines and mixed with writers and editors for so long. I do kind of know who should be doing what story and if they're going to get it, you know, do it fast and if they can do it well. So I would sort of fire off all these emails all over town and get back this great stuff, and up it would go. And by, you know, a few hours later, there it was. And I remember the first time that we had a big traffic hit was just before the Obama election of Obama in 2008. And Christopher Buckley, from the great Buckley Republican family, decided to use, I mean, he was a friend, and so I got him writing straight away. And he decided to write a piece for the Daily Beast saying that he was switching to Obama from the Republican side. And it made enormous news. And it was a big deal when he did that, you know, and it just went everywhere. It went absolutely viral. And that was kind of the launch of the Beast. I mean, once that piece went up, you know, the Beast was born, really, because then people began to think, what is this thing, the Daily Beast, you know, and they began to pay attention to it. And we made a trip. We managed to spend like 6 weeks before the election. We went up, I think the site started in October 2008. We had like 5 weeks to make our bones, you know, before the election and get that last heat. And we did, you know, and by the time the re-election was over, we were a kind of wonderfully new, young, established shop for political news and opinion and arts, culture, everything.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Tina Brown when we come back in just a minute. In the next 60 seconds, you're going to learn how the Flatiron School can change your life. The Flatiron School will teach you everything you need to get a job in code, data science, or design. But they'll also prepare you for the jobs that don't even exist yet, because this is a school designed to educate you in the art of change. So if you're feeling stuck, bored, or unfulfilled, Flatiron will teach you how to change things. You'll learn by making things, breaking things, and discovering how the future is being built. And the results speak for themselves. Go to flatironschool.com/podcast and read about graduates' new careers, salary ranges, upcoming courses, and explore these exciting new careers. You can start building your own new career in coding, data science, or digital design at one of Flatiron's local WeWork campuses, or you can take courses online. Go to flatironschool.com/podcast, read the reviews, and sign up for a free intro course. Enrollment is now open. It's time to future-proof yourself and change things, starting with you. flatironschool.com/podcast. When you need an extra burst of energy but don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. Espresso Monster is a premium blend of smooth espresso and cream. Packaged in an 8.4-ounce can, it's just the right size and perfect for when you're on the go. Each can has 3 shots of espresso blended with European milk just the way the Italians do. At 150 to 160 milligrams of caffeine per can, it's sure to give you the energy you need to conquer the day. Espresso Monster has 2 delicious flavors to choose from, espresso and cream, and vanilla espresso. Produced in Denmark and the Netherlands, Espresso Monster is made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend that's complete with taurine and B vitamins. Whenever I'm having a tough time getting started in the morning or dragging a little bit after lunch, Espresso Monster gives me just the shot in the arm I need to power through my day. And I like their vanilla espresso so much that sometimes I just drink it for the taste of it. Not to mention, it's a lot faster and easier than waiting in line at a coffee place. So close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. And now, back to the show. Now, I remember when Barry Diller was in Hollywood, he had a reputation for being a notoriously difficult guy to work for. Had he mellowed by the time he went into the internet, or what was your experience like with him?
Well, from Harvey Weinstein to Barry Diller, right? You might ask that question.
Who's worse?
Let me see now. Well, no, look, Barry's an old friend. He's great, really. I mean, you know, he gave me that opportunity. He said, run with it. He was fun to work with, actually. I mean, together, we then made a mistake, which was to take over Newsweek and sort of try to put the two things together. That was another one of those crazy ideas that, you know, I should have realized was a crazy idea just 10 minutes after I had it. And I kind of did have the sense it was a crazy idea pretty early on. In fact, you know, within about a month of us buying Newsweek, I thought, you know, this is a bit like being having an affair with your ex-husband. You know, it's like, I left print for a reason.
Right.
And what am I doing back in print? You know, it's done. I mean, weekly magazines, it's impossible to have a weekly news magazine called Newsweek at this moment. It's just not possible. Yeah. Advertisers have fled. And, you know, even before you published an issue, it was losing like $40 million in distribution or something. It was an insanity. But anyway, it was a folie à deux, and we did it. And you know, the Daily Beast got quite a bit out of it because it inherited a whole bunch of great writers that actually were at Newsweek. But, you know, the Beast roars on and Newsweek got sold.
Well, I was going to ask what you thought that you were acquiring when the Daily Beast acquired Newsweek.
Well, we thought that actually it would be good to have a sort of print sister to the online, you know, news site. And actually, we would have been better off doing, I wish now we'd actually started a print monthly called The Daily Beast. I mean, we would have been better off doing that, as a matter of fact, without any of that burden of a union shop, of you know, all that legacy debt and all that crazy stuff. But you know how it is. It's like Newsweek still, it felt like it was still a title that was valuable. But, you know, it just wasn't at that point, unfortunately. I mean, it was really a kind of DOA, too hard to ignite it again. Mm-hmm. It just was too hard. There has been too much water under that bridge, and it couldn't be done, really. And but it was okay because, you know, it was swift. I mean, we had it for a year or two, and the Daily Beast roars on and, you know, has I think it's about 20, 30 million at this point. It's very successful. And And I had a wonderful time doing it. And subsequently, John Avlin, who I hired, took over as the editor. And he actually just left recently, the new editor now. It's wonderful. I went to the 10th anniversary party the other day, and it was so fun to see 3 generations of beasties all of these young, smart people who'd gone on to do great stuff, you know. And again, I felt like I did about The New Yorker and about Vanity Fair and about Talk. It's like, mm-hmm. it's all about finding those fantastic talents and giving them fun, you know, fun things to do and new ideas and good assignments. And, you know, it's a big bunch of people now who've I've been able to do that with, and had a great teams that last, actually. I mean, I think, personally, I think the you know, whether you're a success or not is about what happens after you go as much as while you're there. And if when you go, the whole thing collapses, it means you didn't hire good people, you know, who were the great team. But I, you know, I'm proud to say that both Vanity Fair, all of them, New Yorker, all of them, you know, they went on, the Daily Beast, they've gone on to be very strong animals, you know, and I love that about them.
Yeah, you were ahead of your time. I want to go back to Harvey Weinstein. We talked a little bit about him last time. And after our interview, I read that you said that when you founded Talk Books, the spinoff of yours and Weinstein's magazine Talk, you kept finding these strange open-ended book contracts with attractive unknown actresses. Do you think that was his way of buying the silence of his victims?
I'm not sure it was actresses, but it was various people that we didn't kind of know what they were doing there, who mm-hmm. were female. I think, you know, he probably didn't see it in those terms, or perhaps mm-hmm. that he did. I don't know. I definitely think there was always a double agenda pretty much for everything that Harvey did. And afterwards, I realized that, you know, one of the reasons he wanted to do Talk Magazine was actually that he felt that it would give him power in media to stop people writing anything negative about him or write positively about him.
Yeah.
I mean, he definitely saw owning media as a means to suppressing media he didn't like about himself. There's no doubt about that. And frequently he would assign gossip columnists around town who had been on his case. And the next thing is I would get a call saying, well, Harvey, you know, this is so-and-so from the New York Post, and Harvey told me to call you because he said that you really want to do a contract with me and all the rest. And of course I didn't. And I was stuck with this situation. And it was really about Harvey's sort of wanting to buy them off, yes, I suppose, in his own way.
And speaking of Harvey and the whole Me Too movement, more recently you founded the Women in the World Summit in 2010. What was your goal with Women in the World?
Well, I founded Women in the World as a kind of a platform, a vehicle for women to have a voice who didn't have voices, you know, who weren't allowed or sort of were not, there was no interest in them having voices. I kept meeting during the course of my journalistic life or as part of, you know, my interest in an NGO called Vital Voices, which mentors women in emerging countries. I kept meeting these extraordinary, powerful voiced women heroes, really, who were doing the most remarkable things, you know, in Pakistan and Africa and the Middle East. I mean, women who were, you know, facing down honor killings or arranged marriages or lack of access to any education or simply, you know, cultural repressions, and were just kind of winning nonetheless, you know, who were finding ways to get out of these situations to overcome these adversities. And they were so interesting. I thought, well, it'd be great to put them on stage and have a conference, a summit that allowed them, you know, to become the stars of the show. And at the same time, have women who were well-known, better known, because people would buy tickets, obviously, to see them. So I love doing live events. I'm good at it. I guess it's my sort of producing gene that, you know, producing and editing are very similar. I'd started out, you know, with plays, as we mentioned, and my dad and all the rest. So I think that producing live events also comes to me as a kind of slightly second nature. I mean, I love, you know, creating stage events. And so we started Women in the World with about 300 people in a small Manhattan theater. And it took off like a bucking bronco, like straight away. And by year three, we were moved to Lincoln Center in Manhattan, you know, the biggest kind of one of the most prestigious arts venues in the world, really. And we have 2,500 people, you know, over the course of 3 days. We've really had every sort of prominent global woman. And I mean, what our formula is, which the reason I think it's so powerful, is it's not a kind of talk shop. It's really narratives. You know, we find people with extraordinary stories. I mean, like the last year, we had a most remarkable woman who, for instance, was an Australian sea captain, you know, who rescues migrants from the Mediterranean, you know.
Wow.
An amazing Syrian doctor who operated, you know, in while bombs were falling in Aleppo in Syria, but who was just this wonderful firebrand, marvelous looking, you know, powerful speaker. And, you know, so what we find, we spend a year, I have a fantastic team again of editors, journalists, producers who sort of scour the stories that are out there and curate the best ones and you know, fact check them and interview them and eliminate all but the strongest ones. And then we put them on the stage and we do amazingly powerful video. We do, and then we combine them with, you know, women like, you know, you might go from the sea captain to, you know, Scarlett Johansson or mm-hmm. or you know, Nicole Kidman, or, you know, we have movie stars who have something to say, and members of, you know, we've had Hillary's been every year actually since we began, except for 1 year when she was running. We've had Oprah, we've had we've had every interesting woman, and continue to do so. The next year, incredibly, is our 10th anniversary of Women in the World, and we're already, you know, wow, finding the most remarkable stories that will kind of show where we've got to, and you know, since the post Me Too moment, it's like women are surging in politics, in science, business, etc. But there's still just so much to do, as we saw when you know, there's the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, you know, in the Republican Senate, there was eight white men, you know, between 55 and 65, and you just look at that and you just think, wow, you know, it's still a lot to do. You know, there is women have to keep, we cannot let up in terms of pushing, you know, pushing for that place at the table, which is still frequently, you know, is only very minimal.
And as an extension of Women in the World, you've started this latest venture, your new podcast. I remember last time we met, you told me that you were interested in starting your own podcast. Now here you are with TBD with Tina Brown. What do you find appealing about the podcast medium?
You know, I've really hankered to do this for a while because it's just the sheer feast of being able to sit down without any kind of distraction, any kind of bells and whistles. It's a very kind of pure form. And I mean, I guess I've done everything but podcasts. I mean, I've done monthly magazine, weekly magazine, TV show, written right. books, done an online thing, and live events. But what I hadn't done is this. And it's been a really, I've only done five or six so far, but it's just enormously creative and fun to be able to just simply, you know, invite people to who in my world, because I'm exposed to so many different interesting people, always have done, always had this kind of high low, you know, upscale media, publishing, politics, movies, you know, I love the whole cultural mix out there. And to be able to kind of have a podcast now in which I can invite people on when I run into them and say, come on my podcast, and we really sit and just talk in just a way that is so easy, you know, it doesn't have agenda, it doesn't have a sense that you're rushed. It's great. I just did a wonderful conversation with Margot Robbie and the director of her new film, which is about Mary, Queen of Scots. And then I invited on for the second half the Cambridge historian, John Guy, who wrote the best book about Mary, Queen of Scots. So I was able to kind of combine, you know, these Margot talking brilliantly about this role with then, well, who was the real Mary? And John Guy, you know, is a brilliant man who was riveting, actually. It's coming soon, that broadcast and a podcast, I should say. And I loved doing that. It was fun to be able to do that. I enjoyed, it was like I have two parts of me going on here, my Vanity Fair bit and my New Yorker bit with Margot from Vanity Fair and yeah. Professor Guy from Cambridge. It was just a lovely mix. And I can do old friends like Michael Douglas, who actually just got nominated for a Golden Globe with his Kominsky method, which I think is a terrific show, actually. I loved it. So I invited him on, and he's coming on. He'll be on the air when we come out on Tuesday. And he's, you know, he was just so entertaining. I mean, we talked about everything from how do you choreograph a really good sex scene to what it's like, you know, having gone from being one of the big heartthrobs of the 80s to being a guy playing this aging, failing actor on the Kominsky show. And he's just a great storyteller. And it was just the time flew by.
When you were editor of Vanity Fair and these other media outlets, you were pretty busy running the ship, so you didn't have a lot of opportunities to personally do these one-on-one interviews. In some sense, is what you're doing with Women in the World and with the new podcast an opportunity for you to get back to your journalistic roots?
Yes. I mean, you see, I love eliciting stories from people. You know, I'm a good listener, actually, and that's probably, you know, why I'm a journalist. And I enjoy being the reporter. You know, I enjoy getting lost in a topic and delving into somebody's world or into a topic like who was Mary Queen of Scots and just allowing my own curiosity to drive me forward. And I find that very, very invigorating again, because, you know, it's a lot of, I've done a lot of running and managing and sort of starting up and pushing forward and all of those things. And it's very creative in a way to simply just be able to put all that aside and listen to stories. I love doing it.
Yeah, and some of the most interesting interviews that you've done with Women in the World, as you mentioned, haven't been the big marquee names like Hillary Clinton or Meryl Streep, but guests who most people haven't heard of, women who've overcome oppression, women who are fighting honor killings and rape and promoting education for girls. Once you've established your brand in the podcasting world, are you hoping to expose listeners to more of these unsung heroes?
Very much so, yes. Last year, I had a fantastic woman called Topeka Sam, actually, who, you know, she was a formerly incarcerated woman who, when she came out, started up this terrific sort of halfway house shelter for women who have been incarcerated, because amazingly, there was just no place for these women to go once they came out and just wanted a place to kind of be the base where they can set up their new lives. And she has started that shelter in, I think it's in Queens. And she was just, she's just riveting. I, you know, she was one of the big hits of the summit. And this is what you can never really tell is, you know, who is really going to capture people's imagination. And it's always somebody like that, you know, somebody that you didn't expect, someone who you haven't heard from. I mean, I'm going to be, when Women in the World's 10th anniversary comes around in April, I will certainly haul many of our guests into the studio to talk to them. And I do want to be able to vary completely the mix so that we can have guests that are much, you know, that are very sort of unexpected and that people have come to trust the fact that it's going to be interesting anyway. And I love talking to journalists, by the way. I had Cara, the great tech journalist.
Cara Swisher. Yes, I listened. That was a great interview.
Yeah. She's so interesting. And I love talking to her. I could talk to journalists all night. That's like the old assigning editor in me. You know, I love to listen to journalists telling me what their latest story is. And Cara is one of the great newsy noisemakers right now. And she's someone I respect hugely. She was very interesting indeed.
Last time we talked about Vanity Fair and how important the mix of the magazine was, and I keep hearing that word over and over again today from you. What is the mix, or how important is the mix to the podcast, TBD?
It's very important, actually. It's very important. I want it to be able to do those different sides of me, if you like, and also that high-low range. I mean, it's fun to be able to go. I've got Regina King coming on. We had Jill Soloway, who I think is fascinating. I mean, Jill Soloway.
Yeah.
I thought she was, you know, in a way, I was a little daunted by her. You know, I thought she's going to be so cool that it's going to make me feel like, you know, here's this woman who's been on this amazing gender journey, and actually. I found her just so entertaining and intellectually sort of invigorating. And, you know, in fact, I was quite envious. I thought, oh, my God, you know, I've entered my own phase of wanting to have a buzz cut and and just sort of, you know, to hell with all of that femininity stuff. I'm done with it myself. So it was actually very kind of liberating in a sense to talk to Jill. And, you know, she also was very candid about moving forward with Transparent, her show, without the leading man, Jeffrey Leading Man. He plays her transgender father, Maura, and moving forward without Jeffrey Tambor, because, of course, he's now been accused of sexual harassment. And what a sort of traumatic thing it was, really, for the show and for her. And, you know, she was very candid. She said that Tambor had what she called the wind of patriarchy at his back, which meant that he felt that he could abuse his power on the set, which she said, you know, wasn't acceptable anymore. And she said if she was casting it now, she probably wouldn't cast uh, 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 a straight man. I mean, she would have cast, a transgender person.
Now, speaking of gender in the workplace, what kind of advice do you give to women going into the workplace today?
You do need to be tough. I mean, I don't think that even though things are changing for the better, that women have it easy at all. I mean, I think there's definitely more rigorous judgment of women than there is of men. I think you have to be gold in a silver job. Whatever you are, you have to be better. And that's still true, I think. One thing I've noticed is that when women fail, they have far less second chances than men have. You know, men take care of each other when things go wrong. They hire each other. They invest in each other. They talk each other up. They get each other gigs.
Yeah.
For some reason, it's much less easy if you're a woman. There isn't quite that same network waiting for you, despite the fact I think there's a lot of effort right now to make those networks happen finally.
Yeah, and I also read recently that you had specifically some advice for Meghan Markle based on what you knew about Diana and having written about her. Do you think they're facing similar problems, and what would you advise her to do?
I do. I mean, one of the problems that she's going to face, and probably is facing already, is what the palace used to call with Diana, the quote, the upstage problem.
Ah.
Now, the upstage problem was about the fact that Diana, you know, outshone Prince Charles, outshone everybody in the royal family. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't really outshine the Queen, but even the Queen didn't like to go and open Parliament and find that all the coverage the next day was about Diana's new hairdo. So with Meghan Markle, I think she has to be very careful not to outshine Kate, Prince William's wife, because Kate is going to be Queen at some point, and Kate is having to slightly dampen herself down, be a little duchessy these days because, you know, she's got much less freedom than Meghan has to be herself because she is destined to be queen. But I think that, you know, that Kate has been used to being in the spotlight and Kate has been used to a great deal of adulation. And I think, you know, Meghan doesn't want to necessarily upstage Kate. That wouldn't be terribly smart. And yet controlling that is also difficult because, you know, the press have gone mad over Meghan. There's her story is much more interesting than Kate's. You know, she's a biracial outside the family, came from entertainment world, older. The whole package is way more tantalizing to the press than the more conventional story of Kate. So I think that's a hazard. I think that Prince Harry is you know the most probably the most popular member of the royal family after the Queen. And he's, you know, the two of them are kind of rock stars. But the more kids Kate and William have, the less relevant they really are. So actually, although they're getting a tremendous amount of attention, they're fairly minor in the royal pecking order. All of those things bring tension, I think. And it's interesting.
Smart advice from a woman who's seen it all. Well, once again, I want to plug your podcast. It's called TBD with Tina Brown. I've listened and it's fantastic. Where can folks subscribe? iTunes, Apple Podcasts, the usual?
Apple Podcasts and everywhere that podcasts are found.
Excellent. Well, definitely go check it out and subscribe. Tina Brown, thanks so much for talking with me. It was a pleasure as always.
Thank you. Fun being here.
Thanks again to Tina Brown for joining me on the podcast. Be sure to subscribe to her podcast, TBD with Tina Brown, on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you like to listen. Learn more about her Women in the World Summit at womeninTheWorld.com and follow her on Twitter at TinaBrownLM. When you need energy on the go and don't have time to wait in line, grab Espresso Monster. I had one today, and it gave me just the shot in the arm I needed. Plus, it tastes so good, I'd drink it anyway. That's because Espresso Monster is a premium blend of espresso and cream made with freshly brewed espresso coffee, hormone-free milk, and a unique energy blend complete with taurine and B vitamins. Each can has 3 shots of espresso and comes in vanilla espresso or espresso and cream flavors. Close your eyes, take a sip, and enjoy Espresso Monster today. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.